Hey, what's going on, everybody? It's John, Bam Bam the Dog. First, on behalf of both of us and everybody from the Real Ones team, I just want to sincerely thank you guys for tuning in. The folks that I bring on the show, they're family to me, and being able to tell their stories and bringing you into their world is something I'm just super proud of, and again, grateful that you guys tune in. We decided we want to take things just a step further. We're going to introduce a Patreon community, and basically what that means is if you become part of this community, look, I already bored Bam Bam. If you want to become a part of this community, you're going to be able to hear episodes early and all that, ad-free and all that good stuff. But there's all this behind-the-scenes footage, all this stuff that we've shot that really brings you into the folks that we've had on the show, really brings you into their world. You're going to be able to do live chats with me and the folks that I bring on the show to talk about their world, talk about the issues that they're dealing with, about their triumphs and their tragedies. Just go to Patreon/Real Ones. This whole idea was something about building bridges and bringing people together and bringing folks that often don't get the mic and giving the mic to them. So the fact that you guys tuned in means the world. Anyways, again, thank you. Be good to each other out there. Rock and roll.
Wally, what's up, man?
Hello, hello. How you doing?
How are you?
Good, good. Quite bored, to be honest. We're waiting to go to the front and things are too easy, you know?
Things are what?
Too easy.
You don't like that, huh?
No. So we are preparing to go to the front, but for now things are so easy. Like people in the house now, we have a house for the team, and the people, they're watching Netflix. And the other day, by the way, they really wanted to watch Fury.
So they want to watch Fury. Tell them to watch Fury, man.
Oh yeah. So they were like a bit like prepare for war mentally, you know. So yeah. And here's a war where comfort lives side by side with terror. You know, you can watch Netflix one day and then be killed the other day by a tank.
Crazy, man. crazy.
That's war.
And that's so interesting, man. Terror lives side by side with comfort. And I know you can't tell me where you are, but can you tell me sort of how far from the front you are?
Yeah, now we are far from the front, you know, because there are many units. You know, there's a front line, so it's not like, let's say, Afghanistan or other such places where the front was, where there were hot spots, you know, because I was in Afghanistan and Kurdistan, Iraq. But in these places, they were, I would call it hot spots, let's call it that way. And sometimes it was like a front line, but it wasn't like clear, you know. But now it's very clear, you know, it's, you can drive and go to a restaurant, and then you know that the line is going to be, let's say, 15 minutes, you know, away. And the closer you get to the front, the less, I would say, infrastructure you have. You know, you can, food, sometimes you don't have food, you don't have fuel, you feel the, I would say, the electricity in the air, you know. Oh, but wow. Here, where we are, it's not far from Kyiv, you know. And it's pretty normal life. The other day, I went to a town called Bucha, and I fought there, you know, in urban Bucha. And I went
there just the other day, or you fought there in the past?
Yeah, the other day. Yeah, I fought, not the other day, but I fought, you know, a few months ago in urban Bucha. And when I was fighting, there were lots of smoke and, you know, tanks shooting, destroyed buildings on fire and such. And with my binos, I was looking at the building, you know, and the occupied by Russians. And these were the place from the generals, I was told. And like a few days ago, I went there, you know, at a nice restaurant, you know, the typical restaurant you can have in the United States. It was this place, you know, this neighborhood, you know, where the Russians were. And I look on the map and I said, oh, there's a place where there's a mass grave, you know, not far from here. So we went there, you know, it was maybe 200 meters, you know, from this restaurant that we went. And yeah, so people got killed like Jews by the Nazis there a few months ago. And now there's a memorial that they're building, you know, now about it. And it's not the only one, no. And when we went out of this mass grave, you know, there was a guy noticing that we had uniforms, and that guy shook her hands like crying, you know, and saying thank you, you know. So it's weird, you know, because when you are a soldier used to, let's say, Afghanistan or Kurdistan, Iraq, and such places, it doesn't look like North America or Europe, you know, the place you fight, you know, where you fight. So now it looks like in lots of ways to North America, you know, or a modern country. It is a modern country in some way. It's poorer than some, that's the United States, but it still looks like a lot like a typical North American place. And yet you have all these terrible things happening and terrible things that happened a few months ago. You know? So it's,
does that make it, I mean, you're such an experienced warfighter, but for some, does it make it hard to turn on and turn off because there's such little distance between the hell and the comfort and the hell?
Well, I really don't know. It's maybe because you can be, I remember that like before being almost killed many times in Ukraine, I remember that before that I was, like I said, going to a restaurant, let's say, you know, after, let's say we won in Irpin, between the Battle of Irpin, I think there was one restaurant open and we went there, eat briefly. And then the week after that, we went back to Irpin with the Russians and I was almost killed. So my brain is like shifting between these two states of comfort and like extreme danger. And I was thinking about this fact of comfort and terror living side by side the other day and was like, that's weird, you know? And as a soldier, we're not used to that. So the other day there was a friend, you know, the brothers of somebody we know who offered us a massage, you know, like myself for soldiers. And I felt bad about it. I was like, what? I'm not supposed to be have comfort, you know? I'm a soldier. I'm supposed to be like in the mud all the time and shooting at enemies and such. And I was like, I was thinking about it. And it makes sense because the more modern a country is, the more is at stake, you know? So, you know what I mean? And the more advanced the weapon tend to be. So it makes sense in a way that the more comfort you have in the war zone, the more terrible it's going to be in some way, you know, because you're going to have airplanes because the stakes are higher. You have to, people want to conquer this land where there are some, you know, resources and factories and lands and such. So it makes sense that the more comfort you have in the war zone, the more terrible it's going to be on the front line, you know, typically. So yeah, I was almost killed the other day, like not the other day, but the other time in East by a guided missile, you know, which is guided, you know, and we were pretty sure it is a Cornet. It's called a Cornet. It's called an ATGM, anti-tank guided missile, but it can be used against infantry. And this weapon is so precise, you know, it's like guided missile. So it killed two guys beside me, okay, right there, you know, and it's so powerful and precise and dangerous. And it makes sense because the country is more modern than Afghanistan and Kurdistan. So it makes sense that we have such advanced weaponry on both sides. So at the same time, it's terrible. You know, it's terrible. You can be, you should see the wounds, you know, of the soldiers. The other day, there was this medics giving us, you know, latest feedbacks about the front lines, you know, on some places. And one of the pictures, and I've seen that kind of scenes before, the guy didn't have any, like, mouth left, you know, this part, the jaw was like not there anymore, was all bleeding, and like pretty much after of the face was not there anymore, all bleed, all blood. And I was asked, and I asked, is this guy still alive? He said, yes, he's still alive, but he's gonna have no jaw, that guy. He's gonna be like just half of the face, you know, because of all this explosion, you know, that he suffered. And yesterday I talked to an Americans who was giving us supplies for the front line coming. And that guy has concussion, you know, he's like, he cannot hear from one side.
Yeah.
Because of this massive bombs that landed, you know, beside his places in Zaporozhye in south of Ukraine. Yeah. So.
And Wally, these two guys that died in front of you the other day, they're friends.
Not friends, I would say, but brothers in arms. You know, people I knew briefly, and I remember one of them was speaking French, like I do, and very like just basic French. But he was
Ukrainian.
I remember he's
He was Ukrainian.
Yeah, he was Ukrainian. He was not an experienced soldier, but he had a good attitude. That's typical from the Ukrainians. You know, they're very courageous. You know. Many of them, they don't have the experience as soldiers because it's conscription, you know, so they're sent to the front with minimal training because that's the situation. So he went there into the trench and he was smiling and being a nice guy, you know, and, but he's not experienced. So that's what happened in warfare. It's very like war is, I would say, you know, typically in war, people either underestimate the danger or overestimate the danger. So you see a lot of people panicking or being careless in war, you see. You see, being professional usually is being in the middle. You know, be professional soldiers usually with experience, going to be, I would say, not careless, but not panicking at everything. So they're going to be like in the middle. But you see a lot of inexperienced soldiers when nothing happens. Let's say nothing happens for 3 days, a week, or 2 weeks, and you're not experienced. You might think, oh, nothing happens. It's easy. Okay. Yeah. And then out of nowhere, you're going to be killed by advanced weapon. You know,
sometimes. And these weapons are so advanced. Something. What was going on with these guys? I mean, because in a moment there, can you just walk me through that what happened?
Yeah, in that instance, these guys were TD. We call it TD, territorial defense. So that means basically militias, you know, with minimal training, but very courageous again, very courageous, but no experience. So in that particular situation, we went to, I was doing sniper's mission, you know, and I was telling the Ukrainians commander that this position, this trench in the forest was a bad position because it was too obvious, you know. It's you know, you don't put a sniper on top of, let's say, a church, you know, and because it's obvious, you know, so it's a target for everybody. So they were putting such a trench position in an obvious place, you know. So I told them it's a very bad idea, so you should move this position. So first mistake, the position was obvious. So I went there. And there was this trench, you know, the size pretty much, I would say, of a bed. So it's pretty small trench, you know, with protection, overhead protection, he calls, with a roof, basically. And I went there with my sniper rifle, and my intent was to grab information about the latest, what they saw, you know, these two guys, you know, these two in the trench and in the surrounding. Where are the tanks? Where are the, did you see infantry approaching that way, blah, 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 you know? To get some information, you know, because there's nothing like having information from the people at the front, you know, latest information. So I went there and I was protecting myself behind, you know, the mounds of dirt, you know, because of the trench, they have this amount of dirt. I was protecting myself with my sniper rifle, being very, very careful because I knew that there were enemies in some direction, you know, and so I was protecting myself, putting cam sticks and being very, you know, careful. And these two guys, maybe they were bored in their trench. They went out of the trench, you know? And they were like, there was no war, you know. So we were in the woods, some kind of cover, which was okay, you know, a bit hidden from the enemy, but not ideal, you know. So I told them go back into the trench.
Did you know how close the Russians were at this point?
Yeah, they were pretty much the closest one were maybe still far, you know, they were tanks, lots of tanks in that position. Maybe 1.5 the closest and the first three, but dozens of tanks. They were everywhere. You can see them like you just poke your heads out of the trench and then you can, okay,
wow.
tank. And these two guys, at that point I was in the forest, you know, and I knew there were tanks in that direction, but I didn't know where exactly, you know. And my intent was to kill them with anti-tank weapon, the Javelin, you know? I had the Javelin. I had to learn on YouTube, by the way, how to use that system, but that's
another story. I heard that, man.
So, yeah. So the guy went out of the trench, start smoking, and it was in the morning, so we have to understand that thermal vision, thermal equipment, you know, from the Russian side or any side, especially on the morning, on cold, let's say when it's a bit cold, you know, when it's fresh in the morning, they see more clearly, you know, the bodies and the heat spot moving around, you know. So it's very dangerous in the morning, especially when there's no wind, when it's, you know, quiet, you know, in the morning. So it was in the morning, they went out of the trench. I told them, go back into the trench, you know, that's very dangerous what you're doing. It's the perfect way to get killed, you know. And my teammate, which is a Canadian, he stayed into the trench. You know, I will remember that. He's like, okay, I have no experience. That was his way of saying it. So I'm going to listen to you, Wally. You know, so I told him, I know war is boring because that's war. You know, you have to stay. You have to do. Sometimes your job is to do boring stuff. And now your job is to stay in the trench and be ready in case infantry enemy is approaching and we have to shoot them, basically. So you hide and you do nothing else. That's boring, I know, but that's how war is, you know? So we stare there, like bored and in the mud, you know, with his rifle. And I told him, that's very good. But then the other two guys were like going out of the trench, smoking, being like a big cold, you know? And I told him, go back, go back, go back. And they would not listen. But I was like, the tanks are right there, you know, where are they? And they were, while I was asking this question, and they moved by the edge of the forest, maybe 10 meters away, you know? And for me, it was enough. And I was like, okay, come back, man. That's, never do that. I was like, almost like screaming, you know? Come back, you know? And then they were like, okay, let's come back, blah, blah, blah. And then they came back. And they stayed maybe 2-3 seconds at the outskirts where there was no branches almost. So standing, they went back and I was thinking that's very bad. You know, that's very dangerous what they're doing. So just in case some enemy spotted us, you know, I'm going to move away 15 meters just as, you know, precautions, you know, in case, you know. And I always camouflage with my netting and everything like a sniper, you know? So I move around in some other direction, 15 meters away, I would say, about. And I was with my binos, all with my nets, and I was looking for the tanks. I knew that there were some tanks in that place, and I was looking for tanks. And then it took maybe 10 seconds, huge explosion, you know, very powerful, you know. I remembered exactly how it looked like. I saw the shrapnels, like, you know, like lasers, you know, in front of me, in the smokes, and the smoke, it's hard to explain, but it was like the smoke of death, you know, you feel death coming, taking people, you know, it's very like, I would say, it's hard to explain, but you feel death is there, you know, taking souls, you know, basically, and I was so shocked, I couldn't, like, half of my head was, you know, in concussion, you know, so. And I knew right away that was very bad, you know. So I crawled back to the trench. I was so shaking because on one side, I could not hear anything anymore, you know. And I went under protection beside the trench. My colleague, you know, the Canadian, was still in the trench shaking as hell, you know. But nothing. He had nothing, you know, not a single scratch or nothing, just shaked, you know. And I looked left. And maybe I would say 6 meters away, 6-7 meters away, there were smokes in the air and debris and piece of woods, you know. And I would say 7 meters away, there was this guy, Ukrainian, the one who was speaking French a bit. Very nice guy, very, very nice guy, young one, maybe 25 years old, I would say. And both of his legs were gone. One leg, I think, was all messed up, you know. My memory is not like perfect. I think at least the two legs were missing. And I think one of this arm was missing, but all this uniform was twisted and bloody, and he was not moving anymore. He was on his back, not moving, was dead, obviously. And then the other one, the other soldier, was maybe 2-3 meters away from me, you know, right there, right beside me. And it looked like so much like a war movie. It was like perfectly staged movie scene, you know. The guy there laying on his back dead. The smokes, the woods laying on the soil, on the ground. And then this guy was still alive, the older one. And he was on his side. One of his leg was cut, you know, bleeding. One of his arm was either cut, I don't remember exactly, but he was in a bad shape, as maybe half, you know, maybe, I don't remember exactly, but I think it was one arm not there. And he was full of blood and in a very bad state. And he was still bleeding. He was looking towards me, but he wasn't towards me, but he was towards me, not looking at me. Was his eyes were closed and he was deeply like breathing, like and it was like he was telling himself, what the hell happened, you know? It was like so shocked. Yeah. And then maybe 5-10 seconds after that, he stopped breathing, like a balloon, like deflating, and he died that way, like 2-3 meters away from me. And then it was, I think it was a guided missile because it was so precise, you know. It went right beside the two guys and had nothing except this damage to the ear. And 24 hours after that, I was good. I was good to go, surprisingly. I don't understand how. But 24 hours after that, I recovered from this, you know. But the same day, I could not hear from one side. So yeah.
And while in all your time fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan, like, I know you talked about, you know, now that the stakes are different and it's this unbelievably advanced weaponry. Did you ever see weapons like that before, like that kind of instantaneous power, that sort of capability?
Well, no. Obviously, the Taliban don't have guided missiles, but we were less people protecting the land, so that was different, you know. In Kurdistan, I was a freedom fighter as well, so fighting against Islamic State. So my means, myself, were not very advanced. No, I had, at some point, I had the wood, a Mauser 98 Second World War German rifle.
Wow.
And, you know, we had this kind of rifle. At some point, we had that one AK-47 in Kurdistan, which was not adjusted, zero, we call it in the military. So it wasn't adjusted with, I think, one or two mags, you know. And I went into battle against ISIS with, I think, once it was three magazines, 20 rounds each. And that's less than training in typical North American army, Canadian or Americans, you know. So, yes, the enemy was less advanced, but we were less advanced as well, especially in Kurdistan. So, but now, obviously, the Russians, they have very advanced weaponry. I mean, the firepower that they can deploy, especially in the first time of the war, is immense, you know. When I went into Irpin by foot, you know, not far from Kyiv, you know, in the first days of the war, because I went into the first day of the war, I remember the first time artillery came from Russian. I was in a park, you know, a nice park with the kids, you know, games, you know, and, you know, squeal, and all color and nice. And then artillery, you know, overhead hitting woods not far from us. And then we went into the cities all in flames, you know, in the smokes. And the Russians were bombing the place all day long. You know, it's like nonstop, you know, all the time. And destroying buildings, destroying bridges, destroying anything. You know, they were just like madmen shooting at pretty much everything. Sometimes it didn't make sense. I mean, it was like, I remember that I saw these fancy looking buildings, you know, very modern condos, you know, and they were just shooting at them. I can see the wall exploding, and then they were all on fire.
And Wally, sorry for interrupting you, man, but when you're in that situation, do you feel like you have any control of your own safety, or like how do you, where does that come from? I mean, just for those of us that have never been in a situation like that before.
That's a good question. That's one of the worst thing about war is that you don't have control over many things. You know, the other day I talked to my friends, and he has no military experience, and he was saying, "Oh, maybe I'd like to go, and if I go, I'm gonna do this and this, and I'm gonna go on this type of mission, and I'm gonna do this." I was laughing. I told him, "No, it's not how he's gonna be." In war, typically, you're going to be told that that's your mission. It's going to be maybe a stupid one. Maybe it's going to be a smart one. But maybe it's going to be a stupid one. You're going to know it, but still you're going to have to do it because it's an order. And then you're going to go somewhere where it doesn't make sense. You're going to be bombed. You won't see any enemies. And you're going to die on like just being killed by some remote weapons. You know, that's why I like to call war a terrible disappointment, you know. I've seen so many people going to war, and that's true for Afghanistan, Kurdistan, and Ukraine, going into war with, I would say, a smile and coming back not smiling anymore, you know, because it's a terrible disappointment, war is, you know, in general. You expect things, you expect this glorious war fighting end-to-end with the enemy, and the reality is, no, maybe you're just going to wait in some houses, like I saw, and wait there to be bombed to death, you know, and without seeing any enemies. That's the war. That's war. That's the reality of war. Or maybe you're going to go in the forest and your friends, your soldier that you are replacing, don't have experience. They put mines, you know, in the forest, but because they're not experienced, they told you that they put mines, and then you're going to die by the mines of your friends. Wow. You know? And that happened to some unit, you know, that I know. Okay. This is weird. Precise situation. So that's war, you know. People have this preconception about war, and usually they're terribly disappointed, you know. And there was this American saying the other day that it's, you know, this war is a bit like Second World War, but with Star Wars weapons, which make even worse, you know. A tank can kill you from 3 kilometers away with a guided missile, you know. So, but yes, you lose control in war. And when I got into Ukraine and Irpin, not far from Kyiv, I went into this very strong concrete Soviet-like building. And I said to the Ukrainians, that's not smart to be staying here, because if the Russians, and I was thinking the Russians are as good as the American, you know, that was my thinking at the time. I didn't know that they were not that good. But at that time, I was thinking, okay, it's going to be like fighting U.S. Army, but as a Taliban, so to speak, you know. And I was like, okay, we're going to be like killed in a few hours. That was my expectation, because we're in this place. And obviously, it was easy to detect in some way. So all the Russian needed to do is just to drop a 500 bombs on this building, and that would be over, you know. And when I slept in that building that night, the Russians were sending lots of artillery, you know, around the building. The windows were breaking all the time. The flashes, you see the flashes on the walls, and you know. And I remember I saw this. I was sleeping by the side of a column, you know, a concrete column, which is stronger. And I remember seeing above me the ceiling in concrete. And I was like, okay, I'm going to be buried, you know, crushed by this ceiling in a few hours. I was thinking that, because the Russian, obviously, they know we are not far from here. They're going to drop bombs, and that's going to be it. I'm going to die there. And surprisingly, nothing happened except for the artillery, you know, that night. So the Russian didn't bomb us. But, you know, in war, you don't have control over so many things. And yeah, you have to wait and hope for the best. You know, that's reality.
You know, man, I really want to, you know, since the last time we talked, we talked a little bit, you know, you're such a unique, incredible person, man. And it's such an honor for me. And I want to talk about how it is, you know, we talked last time about how it is to, for me, for lack of a better word, sort of the insanity of it, because you're taking orders. So much of the fighting you do, it's not just that you're volunteering, you're going and you're helping people just completely on your own. Sometimes you're equipped, sometimes you're not. But just for the people that maybe don't, you know, this isn't just for you and me now, this is for a lot of people. So for folks that don't know you, can you just talk a little bit about your name, how you got your name? I've been so fascinated by you, and you're like the legend of Sniper Wally. If you wouldn't mind, can you just talk a little bit about, who you are and as a sniper and how you're sort of considered in the military community?
Yeah. So my, I would say, nickname, known the guy who called it, is Wally. But there's a reason why it's Wally. It's not because it's my real name. It's because my first name is Oliver. So when I went to Afghanistan the first time, 2009, as a sniper in Kandahar region, you know, I was talking with the Afghan, and I looked like Afghan, in a way. So they were thinking I was Afghan. So they were asking me, what's your name, obviously, you know? So I was saying, oh, it's Oliver, or in French, Olivier, you know? And they were like, what? And it was hard to pronounce for them, you know, because the V in any Muslim country is a bit difficult to pronounce, you know. It's like Oli, and it's hard to pronounce. So I said, okay, just call me Oli, you know, like Oliver, you know. And they were like, Oli? Oh, Wally, because the O and the U and the W are the same letters, you know, in the Arabic, you know, Islamic countries, you know, Middle Eastern country. So then, yeah, they called me Wally, and that's a Muslim name, you know, that means like the protector in some way. So it's a Muslim name, so they like me right away. And in Kurdistan, I was called Wally as well, you know, that was my nickname. And here in Ukraine, they call me Vali, you know, like a V, you know, but that's my nickname here in Ukraine. So yeah, I went to 2009 as a sniper. It was amazing. I wrote a book about it, by the way. It's in English. It's called Mission Sniper. You can find it on the Amazon or my website, wally.new. I wrote a book about it. And then I went 2010, 2011 in the mentoring team. And then I went in 2015 as a freedom fighter with the Kurdish Peshmerga against the Islamic State, you know. So it was an amazing experience. And then I went this year in Ukraine, again, as a freedom fighter in the first few days of the war. And I fought in Irpin, so in the Battle of Kyiv. And then I went into the east. And yeah, so that's my little story, so to speak.
And can you just tell me about, you know, I mean, in the, there's a lot of news about you, and I think Putin himself said that, that you were dead. And I just for people to know, man, can you just talk about your history as a sniper and your achievements and what people say about you kind of as a soldier? I know that's a tough, you know, it might be uncomfortable, but I'm sorry. I just want everyone to know kind of who, a little bit more about.
Yeah. So the thing I like to say is that I'm not the best sniper in the world, because there are so many, you know, articles saying, oh, the best sniper, Wally and blah, blah, blah. I'm not the best sniper. I'm just a good soldier. I'm on other good soldiers. Nothing less, nothing more. I prove myself. I'm a good soldier, no doubt about it. But there are other good soldiers, other good snipers, and in a way, better snipers than me, for sure. I'm skilled. I know what I'm doing, but I'm not the only one being skilled, you know? So I'm just a good soldier, and I'm a good storyteller. You know, but it was in a way necessary for the Ukrainians to say that the best sniper was coming to Ukraine, you know, because I was among the first, I think I was in the first group of soldier entering in the beginning of this part of the war, because for Ukrainians, this war is not the beginning of the war, because the war is many years long, you know,
sure,
because of Donbass and everything. So for Ukraine, it's just intensification of the war. So that's why I'm saying this part of the war. But when I came, so to speak, to this war, you know, in the first few days, I think I was in a group with some British, and we were the first one entering the Ukraine at that time. So I remember I was seeing on the social media this publication about the best sniper coming helping Ukraine, and the Ukrainians, they needed these stories about heroes, so to speak, you know, because you have to understand that in war things are very, I would say, psychological, you know. After the facts, in years, historians are going to look at this war and describe facts, you know. Okay, you had this Russian moving and the retreating and so on, very technical. But when you are in the actual event, you know, and you don't know what's going to happen, and you see all these powerful arrows of tanks, you know, encircling cities, and you're going right to between these big arrows on the map, you know, it's a complete different story, you know. Sure. It's so sick. It's mentally, it's so difficult. It's so like something, you know, it's so hard, you know. And for the Ukrainians as well, it's hard. So they have to know that heroes, you know, either true or maybe exaggerated, but people like the best snipers, the best pilots, the best everything are coming helping them, because nobody was coming helping them. Yes, wow. They receive money and weapons, but they were basically all by themselves in some way, you know, defending their lands. So for them, people told me after the fact that they felt the power, you know, like, okay, we're going to win this war because so many nice people are coming helping us, you know, like the best sniper. But in reality, I wasn't the best sniper, you know, but I was a symbol. I was a good soldier, but also a symbol. And the Russian tried to kill me a few times. I know that, okay, by the way. So they tried personally, you know. And they tried to kill me, and because I'm a symbol, and in war you have to kill symbols, because it's all about the will to fight. And if you have heroes, stories, people have the will to fight usually. So they tried to kill me, and they said that I was killed in Mariupol, and while I was in Kyiv. But anyway, and then I didn't have any cell phone on the front line for security reason, obviously. So I went back to the front. I was almost killed, but I wasn't killed. And when I went back, I opened, it was a cascade of hundreds and hundreds of messages, you know, old Facebook friends and people from everywhere asking, are you alive? And then I was basically the last person to learn about my own death, you know.
Because the Russian news, they pronounce you dead.
Yes, many times. And I even saw a picture of me at my funeral, which was a fake. Anyway, there's so many false stories about me. And yeah, either too good or too bad, you know, very bad or very good. So, but the reality, I like to say that reality, truth is sometimes boring or terrible. And, you know, so, yeah, in a few instances, it was boring. It was just me at the front line. Not being killed, almost killed though, but I wasn't killed. So it's just that I didn't have my cell phone. That's why I wasn't answering. You know?
And you understand, you have such a, I mean, understand, you have such an understanding of this psychology of war and how to manipulate hope. And by posting and telling, basically telling the Russians, hey, you haven't killed me. That was a huge psychological win for the resistance. Yeah.
When I came back from Irpin, learning that I was killed. And the first thing I did was taking a picture colored balls, you know, like a game, you know, this pool. How do you say that? Colored balls pool. I don't know how you call it.
Oh, like where a kid jumps into?
Yeah, where the kids are playing with balls.
Yeah.
So I took a picture. I took a picture with a sniper rifle similar to that one, like smiling with my rifle in these colored balls, you know, and just making fun of the Russians. And you know, that's very important because in war, again, it's very psychological, you know. So at that time, Russians were so powerful. So they were starting to lose, but still they were very powerful. They were powerful. They were just on paper the second most powerful army in the world. So and they were saying I was killed, you know, in 20 minutes in Mariupol by special forces, Russian soldiers. So to make fun of it, it's important because it shows that the Russians can be defeated. They're just humans, and you can laugh about it. That's very important. So instead of making this hardcore picture of a sniper behind this rifle and being still alive, I took my rifle and smiling, you know, and just laughing at the Russians. You know, that's what I did.
and while this is maybe as a, I don't know if we talked about this before, but when you're walking around, I think we talked a little bit, but when you're walking around Ukraine, I mean, are you a bit of a soldier celebrity? I mean, does everybody know who you are?
Yeah, of course.
So it's almost like a different role for you. Yeah. It's like, it, not only are you this soldier that everyone's looking to for tactical advice and, but you're also a real symbol. How does that feel, man? Like what's good about that? What's tough about that?
I think I don't deserve it. No, I'm just a good soldier among the good soldiers. I'm very proud that everywhere I went fighting, it's now fear of Russians. You know, there's no Russians anymore. In every places I fought, it's all peaceful now. So I'm very proud about it. But yes, you walk around Ukraine, people recognize me. Yes, but I don't deserve it in some way. I'm just a symbol representing many other soldiers. Yeah, so that's it.
And talk a little bit about, you know, in your regular life, you have a job, you have a family. You know, we talked about it. I know it's a little bit complicated. I know your wife isn't thrilled about you being there. Can you talk a little bit about that? The urge. This is now the second war. You've not just joined voluntarily, but you haven't gone on an official mission with your own country. You've just gone and you've helped people because you believe in the cause. I know you and I have talked about it before, but can you? I'm sure it's the question on everyone's mind. You know what makes you feel like you need to be there? And it's a level of heroism. I think people just have there's no way to kind of even connect with it. Cause it's people don't even step in their own lives. If there's a problem, you know, at the grocery store, a lot of people walk away from it, and you're getting on a plane, you're leaving your family, and you're jumping into this war that you even said you can't have any control of. And you're really risking your life and you're fighting and you're so effective. Can you just, you know, talk about that a little bit?
I'm a soldier and a father, and the two are very hard to conceal, you know. Yeah, it's hard to be a soldier and a father. I'm going to be honest about it. And it's hard to be the wife of the soldier, and it's hard to be a wife of a freedom fighter going on his own. You know, that's hard. And, you know, in life, there are things that are hard, and there's no way around. You know, it's going to be hard, and that's it. You know, you don't have to like it. You just have to do it, you know. And, you know, about this world war, you know, people asking me this question about, you know, why are you doing this? And it's, for me, it's so obvious that it's difficult to answer. So it's like seeing, you know, this big, tall guy bullying smaller kids at school. You know, you have to do something about it. If freedom and justice is important as a person, as a soldier, and you have the skill that can change and help in some way, you know, then you have to do something about it. You know, when people asking me, why are you doing this? I'm like, okay, I feel like, you know, a doctor, you know, in his fancy house, and then he sees somebody bleeding on the other side of the street, and then you stop what you're doing, you go help that person, and then the people asking you, why are you doing this? Well, it's pretty obvious. I'm a doctor. I have skills that can save that person, you know, so that's why I'm doing it. So why are you asking? Because it's kind of obvious to me. So this war in Ukraine is a bit like the, I would say, the American independence, you know, war against, you know, the British Empire. At that time, you know, you have to remember that United States started as an illegal country. You know, it was seen like, you know, rebels, you know, just not wanting to be part of the British Empire, you know, then centuries ago. So in a way, the Russians are seeing the Ukrainian as rebels in the big Mother Russia Empire in some way. So for them, it's not even existing, Ukraine, in some way. It should not be a country. It shouldn't be a people, you know. So it's a bit like independence war for Ukraine, you know, like in the United States centuries ago. Yeah.
In your fighting while you're over there, have you come in any contact with, I mean, I know you've come in contact with Russians in terms of fighting. Have you, you know, whether somebody's been taken captive or has there been any meeting or connection with Russians beyond fighting while you've been there?
Nope. The only thing that was fighting, because you have to understand in war, it's with modern weaponry, there's no like fighting with knives, you know.
Right.
So most of the time it's going to be, you send coordinates about the enemy locations and you just destroy this whole place. Then you go in and there are corpses, you know. There was these Russians trying to kill us with so many weapons, you know, fighting. We were seeing the explosion behind, you know, around us, you know, the dust and everything. I still have the shrapnel and stuff with me. But, and then we start sending artillery, you know, and then we destroy two of their vehicle. And then one of the drivers died burning, Russian, you know, and that was it. That was my relation with that soldier.
Wow.
You know?
Wow.
A remote guy in some advanced vehicle or, you know, a tank. And then he died there. And then I remember I was working with the Ukrainian sniper and they were trying to push us with the infantry, with everything, you know, and they were pressuring us so much, you know, you feel the urge to go away and run, you know, to be honest. And one of the way in war, you know, the mental aspect is so important. You know, you feel the urge to just run and you don't want this, you know, your body doesn't want this violence, you know. And I remember we were holding the place because it was very important in that situation to hold this building, even though it was so hard to hold it mentally. And we were just 8 guys against lots of tanks and people and artillery. And at some point I was with the Ukrainian snipers and we were exchanging position about the Russians moving around, you know. And I remember I was seeing with my binocular a gym, you know, a gym where you train. And when I look and right there, Ukraine artillery fell exactly in the middle of the building, destroying, you know, part of the building. And then the building went on fire because they were Russians who just entered that building. And I remember seeing this all broken windows of the gym. It was a nice gym, you know. And I remember like this treadmills, you know, treadmill for training. And there was this treadmills with broken window in front and all dark and with flames behind the treadmills. So we knew we had killed Russians, you know, and that was just one situation. But that's the typical situation you have in war. You have those remote figures moving around. You don't see them very closely. And you send some bombs, you shoot with machine gun, with many things, you know, and then there are corpses after the fact, you know. So that's my relation with the Russians, so to speak. But yeah.
And while, forgive me, man, but when you're in that situation again, and you feel that urge, you know, this is not where you're supposed to be. And there's, you have to hold it. There's explosions going. And you've been in these situations countless times in your life. Just what's going on in your head or your heart? Like, what are you saying? Cause you know, man, you do everything you always have a smile and a calm disposition. And it's, you know, What's going on with you, man? Like, how, what's going on with, what are you thinking about? Do you, you know, in terms of your loved ones or in terms of the in terms of the people around you, is it the same? Is it a familiar feeling where you say, here I am again, or is each one completely different? I just would love to know how that feels for you and your emotions.
Yeah. It's not as much as what I think as what I feel. It's all about, I would say in the word, fate. No. You have to feel it, you know, because there's so many things telling you should not be there. Others should do the job, go back to your family, but you need faith. You know? So I have faith that it's something that deserves to be done, you know, protecting Ukraine. And it doesn't matter if it's Ukraine in some way. It could be any country, and I would feel pretty much the same, you know. See, you know, I like to say that I have duties, two kind of duties, you know. One is with my close one, my family. The other one is with my community, my country. And the third one is with the world, I would say, mankind. You know, I have three kind of duties. That's why I have to balance between the three.
What's the third, Wally? What was the third?
The third one, mankind, you know, humanity. You know, the world.
Yeah. Mankind.
The world, yeah, mankind. So I have three kinds of duties, so to speak. So I have to balance the three. But it's very hard to balance these things. You know, to be a father and to be a soldier is one of the hardest things.
Talk a little the psychology now of I was reading, and I know there's a bit of maybe disconnect with the information, but I was reading about these sort of like kamikaze drones and these massive attacks on Ukraine now. What and you know, you spoke about the psychology of war, and I imagine it changes day to day. And what is the feeling on the street now, the psychology of the Ukrainian people? How are people feeling right now, would you say?
In a nutshell, I would say resolve. You know, the more Russia bomb Ukraine, the more resolve Ukraine have. You know, it's like this, being a woman being beaten by her husband, and then that's it. She moves away, and then he tries to beat her again, you know, and she would be like, okay, now I know why I'm not with that guy anymore, you know? So it's a bit like that, you know, the resolve is even bigger, you know, and you have to understand it's not that bad, you know, the bombings. From a distance, it looks like it's the whole city is destroyed, but no, in reality, most of the drones are destroyed by air defense, you know? Most of them, I think it's 80% of them are destroyed before. And other ones are not well guided. Now, when you go in some cities and you try to use, let's say, Google Map with your cell phone, at some point, sometimes, you're going to see like you lose the location because they jam the GPS, you know? And that's one of the reasons why even the drones are not destroyed by air defense. They're not guided well, you know? So they hit like apartments or just random targets that don't make any difference on the battlefield. You know, they just, like you say, they kill people still. But in some way, it's a good news because they would be way more useful at the front line, these drones, you know, Russians. Mm-hmm. So in some way, it's good that they are targeting cities in some way. You know, there's nothing good about it, but in some way, it's good because at least it's not killing military assets at the front line. So that's a good part. But you have to understand that the people here have resolve lots of it. They want to get rid of the Russians, and there's no doubt about it. They're gonna fight.
And I imagine that resolve, you know, it brings everybody together. I imagine in such a major way. And I'm wondering, you know, when you go to the restaurants, when you're at a bar, when you're on the streets, you know, can you for those of us that have never been in war, especially war in the first world, you know, what does that do? What is the atmosphere like? Is it? I imagine everybody is so connected and supportive. Is there a sense of, is the sense of community and team? Is it really palpable? Yes. Yeah. Can you? Is it fun?
Well, Kyiv was starting to, and major cities were starting to forget about wars because the front was in Kyiv in the beginning of war, and then move away. The Russians were pushed back, and then the front is kind of far, you know, a few hours drive, you know. So they were starting to forget about the wars, but now they're reminded, you know, in some harsh way that war is still going on. So yes, people they feel like together, like Ukraine, you know, Ukraine's together with you. other Ukrainians, you see lots of flags. You see, you know, it's very powerful because you can drive around destroyed cities and you see this destroyed building, let's say, very destroyed. Like some of them are in good shape, but beside it, you can have totally destroyed building. And you see, let's say, a place where it used to be like, let's say a house, you know, a place, a family living, and you see a flags, you know, flags, Ukrainian flags in destroyed building. That's so powerful, you know, because it tells you that Ukraine still lives, even though its buildings are destroyed, because the soul of Ukraine is still there, you know. Sure. But you feel this. And one of the Ukrainians told me that before the war, some people were still hesitant. They were like, oh, no, I'm not sure. Maybe we're Russians after all, you know. And because of the war, now they saw all the bad things that the Russians did. And they were like, no, where are Ukrainians? No, in some way, Russians solved the, I would say, identity problems of Ukraine, you know. They pushed Ukrainians out of Russia even quicker, you know, than they would have done by themselves. You know?
And so when you're home, when you're with your family, when you're in, you know, the safety of Canada, how does it feel knowing these things are going on over there? And is there ever going to be a time, man, that you're going to say, okay, man, that's someone else's fight?
That is so weird, because the first time I came back from Ukraine, and a week after, I was almost killed again. And I was thinking, okay, maybe I won't enjoy nature anymore, because nature looks like pretty much the same, you know, with some kind of trees, and the smell is similar, you know, the leaves. And I was thinking, oh, maybe I won't be able to walk into nature, because it will remind me. I have a cabin to places I was almost killed, you know. So I was thinking maybe I won't be able to not think about war anymore. And I was okay. I was detached, but I could it reminded me. Okay, I could walk in my woods beside my cabin, you know, in the forest, and I can look at trees, and at some point it looks exactly the same, you know, the same kind of setup, the same kind of woods, the trees, the size of the trees. And I could almost imagine the dead guys right there, you know, beside me. But I'm still okay, you know. But yeah, another time there was this, they were blowing rocks, you know, to build new houses. And then it went off. And then I was like, oh, I was like expecting a big boom, you know, and it was like so tiny compared to war explosion. I was almost like, I want more, you know, I want more explosion, you know, that's nothing, you know. So it could be funny, but at the same time, you have to be careful for security, because I'm a target, so you have to take precautions about that, you know. I cannot talk too much about it, but yeah.
Does anything make you afraid, Wally?
Of course, it's necessary. To be a professional soldier, you need fear. If you're not fearful, but you have to control your fear, you know. But if you don't have any fear, then you're going to be killed very quickly. In war, you know, if you're just courageous and reckless, you're going to be killed very, very, very quickly. You know, let's say that there are tanks shooting and you're like, okay, I don't care, I'm going to fight. Then, yeah, you do it. But in 10 seconds, you're going to be a corpse laying on the ground. You know, you have to be smart. So you have to, you know, it was shooting sometimes, and I was calming myself and others, and I was saying, think, let's be smart, you know. You have to, it's a game, you know. You have to play smart. You have to be a bit like a bull and a fox, you know. You have to mix the two. You have to, sometimes you have to be just courageous and reckless, and other times you have to be smart and think and clever and think, you know. Because if you're courageous and dead, you won't win any war, you know. You have to be a mix of the two. But yeah, you need fear. You need fear.
You said you think, like, how do you control your breath? Like, what do you do specifically physically in those moments? You control your breathing?
You know what's funny? Tiny things could get me upset. You know, like, I don't know, traffic jam. You know, traffic in the city, I can be upset and in a bad mood because of this, and be stressed, you know, stressed out because of this. And then there could be a huge firefight. And I don't know how, but I could feel like, zen, almost zen and calm, you know. There are some videos of my colleague when he was fighting, and I'm kind of moving slowly, you know, like I was doing yoga, you know. I don't know how. And before, that's something funny, before any very critical situation, let's say a very dangerous patrol, I'm whistling, you know, like, and yet that's usually a bad sign, you know, when I'm like starting to whistle. Let's say everybody's tense, nobody's talking. Some soldiers are close their eyes because they know that the patrol is going to be dangerous. They're like thinking like this and smoking and walking around. You feel the stress, and then you can hear the explosion of the artillery. And we know that we're going to go there, let's say, in 20 minutes. And I'm like smiling and starting whistling. And you, that usually means that there's going to be some fun ahead. You know? But I don't know how, but I feel fear, obviously. But I think I can control it. That's the difference.
And last question for now, man. But what about hope? Like, what makes you hopeful?
You know, I think mankind is going in the right direction in general. It just takes lots of time. You know, we have to learn that we have to do the same mistakes. In that case, war many times. To understand that it's not a good idea. You know, we were thinking that war was over in Europe, you know, this kind of war with tanks, airplanes, bombing cities, and such thing. We were thinking, oh, that's over. We learned our lessons. You know, that's bad. Not, don't do it, you know? And then here we go, you know, again. So I think we need, again, I guess, to make the same mistakes, you know, and to learn that it's not a good thing, especially from Russia, because these are the guys attacking Ukraine. But in the long term, I think humanity, you're going to learn, going to understand that it's not good. And we're going to slowly, little by little, go into a more peaceful state. So it's going to be a good thing when snipers and soldiers like me will be useless. So that's my hope.
Well, man. Well, man. Man, I can't thank you enough for the time, man. Is there anything else for now you want to say, or?
What can I say? I will say what the Ukrainians used to say all the time, Slava Ukraina.
Right on, man. Right on. We send you all our love, man, and our gratitude. And I'm very excited to see you in person when the time comes, man. And
I challenge you to come to Ukraine if you want.
Yeah, I said December, but you know, if it's okay.
I'm going to treat you like a lady. Don't worry. You're going to be exposed. It's going to be gradual. Don't worry. I won't put you in some trenches right away. Okay. You're going to see it just... You're going to feel the ghost of war.
Start whistling.
Little by little.
Just no whistling. No whistling.
Yeah, I try, but sometimes I don't think about it. I'm starting whistling, and then the soldier look at me like, uh-oh.
but why?
I sometimes do it.
But maybe we'll check in with you if it's okay. But December, we were thinking maybe I could come in December if it's okay with you.
Yeah, that would be amazing.
Okay, man. Okay.
You're going to feel the heat and the ghost of war. If you want, I challenge you.
Right on. Thank you, bro. I
it was a pleasure.
Yeah, man, the pleasure's mine, man. Please be safe and go hard, my friend.